I want to welcome Marv up to our podium, and his talk was entitled Progress in the Treatment of Heart Failure from Lamentable to Limitless in Only Two Decades. Marv?
Thanks, Mark. That was terrific, and I'm much appreciative. I just want to tell you and everybody here you know, how honored and humbled I am to be here, you know, having an opportunity to give this annual lecture, particularly when I see the people who've come before me giving this lecture. And, you know, it's wonderful to be in Cleveland. I have so many friends here. I have former fellows here that taught me a lot when they came through Tufts Medical Center. I really want to thank everybody in this room because you could have been at the Cavs game, and you could have been at the Indians game. I could have been at the Boston Celtics and see them lose their third in a row to Atlanta. Hopefully that's not going to happen. But instead, you're all here. So, you know, I just really want to thank you. And I did my own little research on Dr. Wiggers, and I think Mark really talked about some of his contributions. And, you know, as I read about him, it was pretty impressive that, you know, in those days, you know, you did it all. As an integrative physiologist, you know, he was a hemodynamicist, he was a pump guy, he was an electrophysiologist. And when you actually go in and look at some of the titles of his papers, it's pretty remarkable the breadth of what he did. So with all this sort of humility that I feel coming here and giving a lecture with his name attached to it, I guess I want to tell you the story about when Mark called me last year and said, you know, Marv, I want you to give the Carl Wiggers lecture. And he then went on and on, you know, sort of like this introduction, by the way. You know, he just sort of kept going and going. And he told me what a great honor it was. And he told me all the people, you know, who did this before and how this is an annual event. And he went on, and I finally just like had to stop. I said, Mark, wait a minute. And I said, Mark, did you see Jerry Maguire, the movie Jerry Maguire? So how many people here have seen Jerry Maguire? Okay, so if you saw Jerry Maguire, you know, Renee Zellweger and Tom Cruise had this on-again, off-again relationship in the movie, and there's a scene toward the end where Tom Cruise bursts into the house, and there's all these women sitting there, and Renee Zellweger is sitting there, and Tom Cruise launches into this speech, this great, great speech that he goes on and on about how he wants to be with Renee Zellweger. And she's sitting there listening. And finally, when he finally comes up for air, she goes, "You had me at hello." So, Mark, you had me at hello. You didn't have to go on and on. I can't believe that I've been so honored to give this talk. So, hopefully, I'll give it justice. So, this is the title of my talk: Progress in the Treatment of Heart Failure from Lamentable to Limitless in Only Two Decades. I'm very proud of that title. It took me about 3 hours to think it up. This is my disclosure slide, which I'll leave up there for a moment. So I'm going to take you back not that long ago. So I was a staff cardiologist at this time. You know, in fact, I'd been on staff for 7 years in 1988, and this was 20 years ago. And this was the therapy for heart failure in 1988, digoxin, diuretics, and bed rest. It's sort of unbelievable, because none of these really work, right? And they certainly didn't work to keep people alive or anything like that. And bed rest, for heaven's sake. We'll come back to bed rest at the end. And what was the prognosis? Progressive disability, uniform mortality. That really was what we were working with. And it's sort of startling, I think, for cardiology fellows today to think about this. That's what we were doing in 1988. So this is what we're doing today. We actually do other things besides what's on this slide, but this rainbow are all the all the interventions that have been documented in prospective randomized controlled trials to have an impact on clinical outcomes, on clinically meaningful outcomes. With the exception of diuretics, there's never been a good randomized controlled trial of diuretics, but everything else that's ever been looked at has been on the background of that, so we have to throw that in as background. But here's, you know, here are the interventions that we juggle, you know, when we care for heart failure patients from mild to severe. And if you want to just sort of estimate the impact that we've had on important outcomes like survival, this is my estimate of it, just from three simple stepwise advances that we've had in pharmacotherapeutics dating back to about 1991 when the SOLVE study first came out, about a 28% reduction in mortality overall when you look at all the trials with ACE inhibitors. Add on top of that beta blockers, and you get roughly, adding all the trials together, about a 34% reduction in mortality. And if you add aldosterone blockers, at least to selective patients, you may get an additional benefit. I put on 15%. That's sort of a very rough estimate. So we've made headway just by doing that. Here is, someone asked me in the hallway, you know, what are the recent advances in drug therapy and heart failure? Well, we're sort of in a latent period the last few years. We really haven't had another blockbuster advance in drug therapy, you know, in the last 5 years or so. This is really the only one that you can point to that is, a phase three outcome-related trial showing improvement on existing therapy. It's with the combination of hydralazine and isosorbide dinitrate, of course, and this study was done, the AHEF study, in an African-American population. And this therapy is far underused, I might add. But this is sort of the last thing that we've had in drug therapy to have a benefit on outcome. Now, heart failure continues to rise in prevalence and incidence in terms of events. And the panel on the left here, is there a pointer? Does this thing work? What? Okay. So this panel shows the prevalence of all cardiac diseases over time. And as you see, that really has been a leveling off, if not sort of a decline, in the prevalence of mortality associated with all cardiovascular diseases. And why is that? We don't know 100%. We think that some of the preventive strategies in terms of cholesterol, blood pressure, diet, have had an impact. There may be a recrudescence of this coming up as we're dealing with an obesity epidemic and a diabetes epidemic. But if you look at heart failure, and you got to be careful because it's a very different scale, but just to blow it up, heart failure appears to be sort of on a relentless incline of increasing in the prevalence of heart failure and the incidence of hospitalizations and deaths associated with heart failure, and that's continuing sort of year by year. Thanks so much. Okay. And so that's sort of the substrate that we have to deal with. So is there a need for more therapies? The answer is absolutely yes. We've made enormous headway, but we still have enormous challenges in terms of the increasing prevalence of heart failure. Now, this is the disease, and I would say, conceptually, one of the major advances that has been associated with our improvement in therapy is a recognition that the disease heart failure, the clinical disease heart failure, is associated with a progressive process that's become known as ventricular remodeling. And that process is associated with pathologic hypertrophy and increases in interstitial collagen. And there are various stresses or conditions that lead to it, and the three most common are shown in this slide. Ischemic cardiomyopathy, dilated cardiomyopathy, idiopathic, well, that's the best we can do right now is call it idiopathic dilated cardiomyopathy, and hypertensive hypertrophic disease. People refer to this as systolic dysfunction, and this is diastolic dysfunction. People who know me or have worked with me or have heard me speak know that I don't like those terms, for a number of reasons. One is because all of these hearts are abnormal in systole and in diastole. All of them are characterized by increases in LV mass and in interstitial collagen. And the differences between, and all of these hearts in vivo are abnormal both during systole and diastole. The myocardium in each of these hearts is severely abnormal both during systole and during diastole. And the differences across these different etiologies and the way they appear really is the manner in which the ventricle has chosen to remodel. In the two circumstances on the left, there's been remodeling with progressive dilatation, and on the right, there's concentric hypertrophy and if anything, a shrinking or certainly not an enlargement of the ventricular cavity. So these are structural differences under these circumstances, and they do result in differences in ejection fraction. And so recognizing the importance of ventricular remodeling is critical, and I'll show you why in a moment. But the other critical finding, which has led to all of our major pharmacologic advances, is this slide, the author of which is in the room, Gary Francis. You know, this is one of the most commonly shown slides in lectures in heart failure around the world. And it shows that there is a progressive degree of neurohormonal activation in patients with heart failure. And it seems almost trite to refer to this right now, but it's this finding that really is critically linked to our pharmacologic advances. And the therapies that we have, ACE inhibitors, beta blockers, aldosterone blockers, have as their origin a recognition that neurohormonal activation has something to do with the ventricular remodeling process. So here's the evidence for that, and this brings the two points together, ventricular remodeling and neurohormonal activation, and it's an old slide from the ventricular function sub-study of the SOLVED trial, which was a randomized controlled trial of enalapril against placebo, and this is a small cohort where we were able to look progressively at left ventricular volumes, and we demonstrated that left to their own devices, these patients progressively dilate over time. This is left ventricular end diastolic volume over time. But if you give an ACE inhibitor, you don't see that. You see instead an early and sustained reduction in ventricular volumes. And that is associated with improved outcomes. So basically, this was one of the first observations of concordance between an effect on ventricular remodeling and an effect on clinical outcomes linked through neurohormonal activation. So this is, we jump now to the present, and this is from an abstract just presented by Dan Kramer, who's a house officer at Tufts Medical Center, an analysis really driven by Jim Udelson, one of my colleagues. And what they did here is they looked at 25 different specific interventions in heart failure patients for which the effect on clinical outcomes is known. Based on large-scale randomized trials. And for each one of them, they estimated the odds ratio for survival based on all the trials that were available. And they related it to study by study to changes in ventricular volumes with that particular intervention. And although there's some noise in here, I think you can appreciate that those interventions that were associated with a reduction in ventricular volumes were associated with a reduction in mortality. And those interventions where you were unable to demonstrate a reduction in ventricular volumes, those interventions were not associated with a reduction in mortality, and in some cases even an excess of mortality. So this, I think, is the best display that I'm aware of to date, showing the importance of the ventricular remodeling process and the importance of influencing it on the process that leads to adverse clinical outcomes. Now, I like to show this slide because I like to remind myself and others that it's not all about the heart. In fact, we know now that the kidneys are an essential conspirator, if you will, in the syndrome of heart failure, and the vasculature is a major conspirator. And in fact, diseases that lead to heart failure are often diseases of not only the heart, but the vasculature and the kidneys as well. Hypertension, atherosclerosis, you know, all affects all three of these organs. And in fact, all three of these organs, I believe in many patients, particularly the elderly, conspire to drive the various syndromes of heart failure. And I'll use that word syndromes because it really isn't a monolithic presentation. There are different syndromes of pulmonary congestion, systemic congestion, and low output, which are overlapped. and are driven by these three organs, the heart, the kidney, and the vasculature. So this is a study by Ayan Patel, who directs the Echo Lab at Tufts Medical Center, and she's very interested in endothelial function in heart failure and is also very interested in the effects of cardiac transplant. And so what she did here is looked at flow-mediated vasodilation and marker of endothelial function and looked at it in heart failure patients compared to controls. So control subjects in yellow and the two heart failure cohorts in blue, ischemic patients and non-ischemic patients. And on the y-axis is flow percent dilation of the brachial artery in as a flow-mediated response as a marker of endothelial function. And you can see how perturbed it is, how reduced this endothelial response is in these patients compared to normals. By the way, this pointer is dying, so if you've got another one, that'd be great. Oh, it woke up. I scared it. Okay, so we'll see how long it lasts. So there's something about heart failure, and there's something about heart failure in ischemic heart disease and something in non-ischemic heart disease. But I think the most interesting finding is what happened after cardiac transplant. And there you see a difference between the ischemic and non-ischemic patients. Patients who had ischemic heart disease as the etiology of the heart failure, when they had transplant, those who had non-ischemic heart disease, who did not have atherosclerotic disease, when they had a transplant, they had normalization of endothelial function. Whereas those who had atherosclerotic disease had no normalization. And this, to me, is like one little observation that just sort of explains or points the way to so much. It says to me that there's a couple of different things going on. Atherosclerosis drives endothelial dysfunction. And so even if you transplant the heart and correct the heart failure hemodynamically that way, you're still going to have endothelial dysfunction. But if the endothelial dysfunction is in the absence of atherosclerosis, then it's probably hemodynamically mediated. And then if you correct the hemodynamics, you normalize endothelial function. So this really sort of lays out the importance of endothelial function or dysfunction in various cohorts of patients with heart failure. These are a couple of studies that are probably well known to you. They demonstrate the effects of aldosterone blockers, either post-myocardial infarction or in a more stable heart failure population, in both cases showing the improvement in clinical outcomes and mortality. But what is it that's driving this effect? You know, we don't really know that. Is this some effect on the heart? In fact, we have data that fail to demonstrate a substantial remodeling benefit from aldosterone blockade in a heart failure cohort. And I want to propose to you that there might be something else going on, and what might be going on is, in fact, in the vasculature. And this is the work of Iris Jaffe and Mike Mendelson, who are very interested in mineralocorticoid receptor effects in the vasculature, and they looked at human smooth muscle cells in culture and examined the effect of mineralocorticoid administration to these cells in culture and looked at gene expression in response. And the genes that were upregulated in response to mineralocorticoid receptor administration were first collagen was upregulated, genes that are responsible for calcification were upregulated, and genes that are linked to inflammatory processes were upregulated. So there are all these adverse factors in the vasculature going on that are mediated through a mineralocorticoid receptor, which are potentially inhibited when we give a mineralocorticoid receptor antagonist. And I just want to propose to you that when we give the drugs that we give in heart failure, ACE inhibitors, and, as I point out, mineralocorticoid receptor antagonists, some, if not most, of the improvement in outcomes that we see may not be mediated through cardiac effects, but may be mediated through vascular effects. So the story with chronic heart failure is a nice one. We've certainly made enormous headway with drug therapy. Not so promising or favorable is the story in acute decompensated heart failure. And, you know, those of us taking care of patients with acute myocardial infarctions, you know, and think about the way we did it 20 years ago or 25 years ago, and think about how we do it today, you realize how much advance we've had in improving outcomes of patients who present with acute myocardial infarctions. Not so in patients presenting with acute decompensated heart failure. We have not had a single trial performed in the setting of acute decompensated heart failure that has demonstrated any effect by any intervention to improve clinical outcomes, not a single one. And these are the drugs, you know, I was talking with Eileen Sheesh, one of our outstanding former Tufts Medical Center fellows, who now is doing wonders in Cleveland, and I asked her, you know, tell me about drugs that are that we use today in treating heart failure and the outcomes associated with those drugs. Tell me any drug that we know has a favorable outcome. And it turns out there isn't any. And this was the regulatory approval basis for each one of these drugs. And these are the outcome data that are there, either adverse outcome data, questionable outcome data, or just no outcome data. And that's what we have. So it's not a really great circumstance. And where we've written, I'm working now on a clinical practice guideline component for the HACC, and we're trying to tackle acute decompensated heart failure. Gary Francis is on that panel. And we're struggling, and we know that whatever we come up with is going to be level C evidence, not based on good outcome data. So in light of that, I just share with you a trial that we published a year ago now with a new approach. And I'll bring back to Gary's slide and point out sort of the orphan neurohormonal activation, and that is arginine vasopressin, which is upregulated in heart failure, and for which we have not until recently had drugs that can impact on this agent or inhibit it. And now we do. And so this is a drug that we've investigated, tolvaptan, which is a selective V2 receptor antagonist. The two major receptors are the V1A and the V2 receptor. The V2 receptor is what's responsible and present in the renal tubules and responsible for free water reabsorption. So we've been investigating vasopressin receptor antagonism in the setting of acute heart failure now for a number of years. And this is, when I say we, a lot of this work has been done by Jim Udelson. And this is a study that he did a few years ago looking at this agent, tolvaptan, compared to placebo and compared to furosemide, and looking at changes in body weight over 8 days. And what you see here is that 30 milligrams of tolvaptan is more effective at reducing body weight in a heart failure patient than it is 80 milligrams a day of furosemide. And when you put the two together, you get about the same as you did with the tolvaptan alone. So this is interesting. It's perhaps a novel way to approach fluid overload. And on top of that, there's evidence that when you give vasopressin receptor antagonist, you have relative preservation in renal hemodynamics and less increase in serum creatinine. There have been a number of studies that have shown that. So maybe this is something that we can use in the setting of acute decompensated heart failure, particularly for hyponatremic patients and particularly for patients whose renal function is worsening during therapy. So this is the one slide that I'll show from the acute portion of the Everest trials. The references are here. It actually was two companion papers published in JAMA last year. And, you know, is this a cup? Are you a cup half full or cup half-empty kind of person, because it wasn't a blockbuster result. But what we did show is after a day of therapy compared to placebo on top of standard baseline therapy, that there was more weight that came off, and associated with that reduction in weight, there was an improvement in the distribution of dyspnea scores in the tolvaptan-treated patients compared to the placebo patients. There were two trials, two companion trials that were done, trial A and trial B. They were identical trials, and both showed the same thing. So patients tended to be less dyspneic at the end of a day, and that was the number one finding of the study, cup half full or cup half empty. What I like about it is that we don't have anything else that's ever been shown to do this. The closest we have is nisiratide, where it's been shown at 3 hours. So that's sort of where we are. The bad news is that giving that single dose of the drug, starting it in the hospital, continuing it in the hospital, and continuing it long-term forever, we did not see an improvement in outcomes. We did not see an improvement in mortality. And a bit of a surprise to me, we didn't see an improvement in recurrent hospitalizations, which I thought we might have seen. Now, we didn't see an excess in mortality, so from a safety perspective, That's favorable compared to some of the other things that we have in acute heart failure. So I'm sad to report that this is about the best we have in this condition. The good news is there are now numbers of trials that have started up, and we're focusing on this issue. But it's an extraordinarily difficult condition to treat. Patients are unstable. Treatments are changing as we watch. The endpoints are difficult to nail down, so it's been a tough area to explore. So I want to move from drugs and ask the question, you know, is this decade the decade of the 2000s, I guess? I was going to say the 70s. Where was my head? Back in medical school. Is this now, if the last decade was the decade of advances in drug therapy, is this the decade of devices? And so here are some of the devices that have been or are being explored in patients with heart failure. And I'll just sort of touch quickly on the low-hanging fruit, so to speak, things that people in the room know about, but very important advances that we know that there are cohorts of patients that are now well established to have reduction in mortality with an ICD. Patients who have a post-myocardial infarction and patients who may or may not be post-myocardial infarction, New York Heart Association class 2 and 3 mostly, low ejection fraction, either below 30% in this case or 35% in that case. So we now sort of have adopted a standard practice for patients that meet those criteria that they should be offered an ICD. And then we have resynchronization. You know, I view this, you know, as really a major advance, both conceptually and clinically, because we now understand that ventricular dyssynchrony is something that occurs in heart failure and doesn't just occur as an epiphenomenon, but actually is part of the progression of cardiac dysfunction. Because when you put in a biventricular pacer and resynchronize, you get an improvement in ventricular volumes and you get an improvement in outcomes. In this study, with it done alone without an ICD. So those are sort of the obvious things. Now, we have these that are coming along, which are the ventricular assist devices. And ventricular assist devices have been around for some time now and have been used, of course, as so-called bridges to cardiac transplant. But there are newer devices coming along, these low-profile axial flow pumps that can fit in a hand and we believe are associated with reduced morbidity associated with the implant and less patient discomfort. And so this is sort of moving to a new era, and what you're going to be seeing in the coming years is either even lower profile devices and, in fact, devices that can be put in less invasively than these intrathoracic devices. And I just want to sort of share with you the promise. I don't really think we're there, but this is the promise. You know, this is a slide from Donna Mancini back from the mid-90s that simply demonstrates how effective these bridging devices are at unloading the ventricle. So this is a patient with a cardiomyopathy who has a ventricular assist device in. This is with the device turned off, and this is with the device turned on. And so, yes, the device pumps and it keeps the patient alive, but it is also the most dramatic thing that we have for ventricular unloading. And this has led to the theory that perhaps we can put these in, keep patients alive, perhaps start other drugs at the same time, some of which may be doing something, some of which we don't know whether they're doing anything or not. But this is data from Great Britain, from Maggie Yacoub's group, where in an uncontrolled way, they implanted mostly the heart-made vented electric device in patients, and then if they met certain criteria, the device came out again, and then they followed the patient over time, and looking at left ventricular ejection fraction, end-diastolic dimension, and systolic dimension, and VO2 max, there is a sustained benefit that's seen. So at least in these patients, it looks like their hearts had gotten better. Now, I will tell you that my own reaction to this is the promise. You know, this is the beginning. I don't think we're there yet. I don't think this wasn't really a well-controlled study, frankly, and I think we don't know enough about who's going to benefit, who isn't, when should these devices come out. There are actually very few devices in the United States that are going in and coming out again, but it's the promise, and I think as device development goes on and we get devices that can be implanted more easily, and we get smarter about it. Maybe it's not just pumping. Maybe we need to think about other things that the devices can do. We may get into a situation where we can implant devices, such as the CRT device is sort of a prototype in a way of this, of a device that can be implanted and can actually improve underlying cardiac function. And I think that that's something that I believe that we're going to see in the coming years. Oh, I mentioned I was going to come back to bed rest. So we don't put people to bed anymore. You know, as a fellow, I was taught by one of my mentors or many of my mentors, you know, what you do is you put people to bed for 6 months. And it's sort of barbaric when you think about it. So this is what we think now. Doctors have long suspected that exercise might be good for their patients. And so be honest, how much are you exercising? So this is a guy who may have been put to bed by his doctor at one point and never got out. And so actually, if you look at exercise in patients with heart failure, it turns out that there are meta-analyses that have demonstrated that, have suggested at least, that regular exercise programs can improve clinical outcomes in patients with heart failure. And I wanted to mention, oh, and so the question is, by the way, how does that work? You know, we think exercise reduces myocardial infarctions, and exercise seems to potentially improve clinical outcomes in heart failure. How does it do those things? I mentioned the vasculature earlier in my talk, and I'm coming back to it now. My own bias about it, and I can't prove that I'm right or wrong, but that all of these impacts, particularly the effect on recurrent ischemic events and on other events in heart failure, may not be cardiac mediated, but may be vascular mediated. It's just a thought. And this is a nice, interesting slide showing immunofluorescence stains of endothelial cells under different conditions. On the top is static endothelial cells in culture, and on the bottom are cells in culture that are subjected to a steady laminar shear, you know, such as you would get with a steady flow forward. And you can see that over a period of time, actually a very short period of time, the cells change, and there's changes in protein expression, proteins that are responsible for the intracellular matrix of the cell, and the cells start to line up in the direction of the stress, of the shear stress. And I want to propose to you that exercise may be a factor that may be providing us with intermittent laminar shear for our vasculature and our coronary circulation that may remodel them and make them relatively protective to processes such as atherosclerosis. So that's just sort of my suggestion that we may learn more about in the future. I wanted to mention this clinical trial that's being run out of Cleveland by Ileana Pena. It's the HF Action trial where this question is being put into action, where patients with heart failure are being randomized to exercise or not, with the primary endpoint of all-cause mortality or all-cause hospitalization. And so we're going to get a very interesting result from that. And maybe we can learn something more from those data about whether we think it's occurring because of effects in the heart or effects on the vasculature. Well, Mark mentioned that I'm presently at the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute serving as senior advisor in cardiovascular diseases. And so I wanted to mention a little bit about what goes on there. This is the strategic plan of the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute that was developed with outside help over the last couple of years. Pick it up sometime and read it. It's sort of interesting about directions that we're going to go in. I work in the Division of Cardiovascular Diseases, which is the extramural program of the National Extramural Cardiovascular Program of the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute. And over the past few months, our staff have been working on a Division of Cardiovascular Disease strategic plan, and what we produced is a list of 35 specific goals in specific disease states and in enabling technologies and in training that we would like to see implemented over the next 5 to 10 years. And so some of the directions that we're beginning to turn to and may bear fruit and may take longer to bear fruit are cardiovascular progenitor cell effects. And so I'll mention that the NHLBI has funded a cardiovascular cell-based therapy research network. These are three trials in that network that have started up to sort of explore whether cell-based therapies can improve clinical outcomes in various clinical substrates. And back to this slide again, I'll mention personalized medicine. That's a buzzword that I hear an awful lot. Different people mean different things. What it basically means is that don't take everybody with heart failure and say they're all going to benefit from a beta blocker. Maybe we can get smarter than that. And one of the ways we might get smarter than that is in pharmacogenomics. And so I thought I'd make a slide of a paper that was just published within the last 2 days that sort of shows, again, I'll sort of paint this in the same light as I painted the bridge to recovery with ventricular assist devices. This is a promise. I wouldn't say this is here, but the promise is shown here. So these are two different genotypes of G protein-coupled receptor kinase. This is a protein that finally regulates beta receptor activity in response to stimulation. And these two genotypes within the African-American community, this is a minority genotype, which nevertheless is quite prevalent. And in this genotype, this particular protein is upregulated. And what the authors have referred this to this as is sort of an endogenous beta blocker, you know, is that the adrenergic nervous system is sort of endogenously protected from catecholamine excess. And so what they find here is that in this genotype, when you add a beta blocker, you don't see any difference between beta blocker use and non-beta blocker use, whereas if you have the more prevalent genotype that is more like one might call wild type, that's where the money is, because this does not have an endogenously downregulated beta receptor. I call this promise. I wouldn't run and try to put money in the company that's going to do this, because I'm not, if there is such a thing, because I'm not sure whether this particular finding is going to hold up or not. I personally am somewhat skeptical when I see a slide that has 8 events in one group, when we're doing other studies that have 4,000 patients and hundreds of events. But nevertheless, this is the promise that at some point we will be using pharmacogenomics to influence our therapy. So here's where we are, and so all of this advance back from the 1980s, you know, what has it gotten to us? And this is a snapshot of it, and this is a sequential look at the control group in several clinical trials that have been published sequentially. And what you saw in the SOLVE study compared to all the way over here, which is the more recent Valheft study in the group of patients who are already receiving ACE inhibitors and beta blockers, you know, more than a halving of the in the annualized mortality rate. And so this is what you get today if you actually put patients on the drugs that have this effect, a pretty dramatic effect from the late 1980s to the late 1990s into the 2000s. And so this is the bar that we have to shrink further, particularly in the patients who have most severe disease. So treatments for heart failure, you know, we've had a lot of advances with drug therapy. I've mentioned the decade of the device and perhaps the promise of things like ventricular assist devices as bridge to recovery, progenitor cells that may be able to differentiate into myocytes, personalized medicine. But I guess I want to end with this picture. This is the family of a patient of mine, name is Serge Desir. And in my most recent annual lecture to our second year medical school class, I dedicated the lecture to Mr. Desir. He was my patient for over 15 years. This slide was taken 18 months after Mr. Desir's heart transplant. Okay, I'll say it again. It was taken 18 months after Mr. Desir's heart transplant, okay? So this really shows, on the one hand, that there is life after heart transplant. But I want to say that I had the privilege, before I went down to Washington, I extended my trip. One day I was going to leave on a Saturday, and I decided to leave on a Sunday because on Saturday evening there was a big celebration in the Haitian community in Boston celebrating the 15th anniversary of Mr. Desir's heart transplant. And I was invited, and I put my trip off, and I spoke at that meeting, and I was really feeling very privileged to be there. I then, the next day, moved down to Washington, and I'm sad to report that about 3 weeks later, he passed away. And so, you know, for as long as I give my lecture to the second-year medical students at Tufts University, I'm going to dedicate the lecture to Mr. Dazeer and his family. And the reason is that this is what it's about, right? It's not, you know, the technology and the drugs and the devices are getting us there, but it's pictures like this. 15 years is a nice period of time, and having this young man and being able to watch him grow up, and he's now 14 years old, you know, is quite gratifying. And hopefully, if you, you know, 15 years from now, if you just can't find another Wiggers lecturer and want to invite me back, you know, hopefully we'll show that, that we're in even a better place than we are now compared to 1988. Thanks very much.